You are listening to The Nature of Things on WRVO. This essay first aired on July 15th, 1988.
It's an ill wind that blows nobody good. Isn't that the way the saying goes? It has its corollaries in nature, but in the natural community, to which value judgments are foreign, we talk about limiting factors, not good or evil, and realize that drought, bad for moisture-loving plants, may actually assist drought-tolerant ones, which prosper during the depression of their moisture-loving competitors. May Teelgard Watts, in her classic book Reading the Landscape, includes the following unattributed quote. Yes, it is ever demonstrated that the extremes determine what is to be the native vegetation. The kind of grass that the shoe fits can put it on. Some wet years it fits the cord grass. Some dry years it fits the blue stem. So we see the prairies have had their cycles of drought and dampness from the beginning of their existence. But unlike the prairie farmer, the prairie grasses can wait until conditions are right for them. Drought in nature is simply one of the choices available, a gift to one, a distraction to another. Let's look at the local effects of the drought on the natural community. A few days ago, Bob Peel, in his outdoor column, quoted DEC game manager John Proud to the effect that this dry year should be a good one for pheasants, grouse, turkey, and woodcock nesting. He could also have included those rails, ducks, and other wetland nesters fortunate enough to have a residual water supply at their nest site. The remaining water could be unusually rich in aquatic life, forced to concentrate in the dwindling water reservoirs. Good foraging for the chicks. Still, this last wetland could be skating on thin ice, too. Too much hot, dry weather can also greatly increase oxygen demand and result in the increase of toxins in the water. I once studied a 16-acre wetland, 12 acres of which was carpeted with duckweed. The marsh was alive with a great variety of plants and animals. Ecologically, it exuded the sweet smell of success. Within 10 days, it had become a noxious, malodorous brew of dead fish and amphibians, nearly deserted by its bird life. That was during the first week in July. By mid-August, the healing processes had fostered a new carpet of duckweed over half the pond. In addition, it was obvious that many of the smaller fish and amphibians and a portion of the insects had actually survived the ordeal, and that mink, coon, and crow had actually prospered, dining on the carrion. Nature is cyclic, and everything that dies in one way or another fosters new life. That even extends to the matter of bottom soils and soil nutrients. During years of high water level, certain nutrients become progressively locked in semi-soluble or insoluble salts. In certain wetland underlain by acid soils, plants become thin and impoverished. Drying up of the wetland exposes the bottom soils and aerates them, oxidizing the heavy metal salts and returning them to soluble forms. When the water returns in another year or two, a rich growth of aquatic plants develops in what had seemed a sterile environment. Lowering of water levels always results in an increased growth of emergent plants. Conversely, we can see the ills of too much water, especially when water levels rise rapidly. I was doing a study of red-winged blackbird nesting in an ideal 20-acre marshland about 100 yards from the shore of Lake Ontario. Dozens of male redwings had set up territories there, each territory harboring several nests. In all, I studied nearly 90 nests that year. I started the study in early April, before any redwing nest had been built. By mid-May, there were a dozen and a half nests, about half of them located in emergent herbaceous vegetation. The reeds were still very short, so all of the nests were located with their bases within 6 inches of the normal spring water level. Many of the structures were in precarious supports. On May 18th through 20th, there were torrential rains. The water level rose 6 inches, and all but three of the herb-based nests were flooded. Nests located in shrubs were all but one more than 6 inches above the water level. None of the nest failures there in the shrubs could be attributed to high water. Some other ground nesting birds were flooded out, but the bulk of gallinules, least bitterns, black terns, and Virginia rails that nested there followed after the big flood and escaped its ill effects. Similar scenarios can be drawn for the effects of the drought on upland plants and animals. And always it seems that what is ill for one organism is prospering for another. And nature is hardly traumatized at all by what often devastates us. Well, that's all I have for this week. This is John Weeks saying thanks for listening. Tune in next week and keep it natural.